The information shared in this podcast is intended for entertainment purposes only. It should not be considered as professional legal advice or a substitute for seeking professional legal advice. This is Love Less Law, and I'm your host, Michelle Locke. I spent 23 years practicing as a divorce attorney and presided over more than 5,000 cases as an associate court judge in Texas over a dedicated family violence court. I'm also the child of divorce, and after a 22-year marriage, I've been through one of my own. When I say I've lived every side of family law, I mean it. Now I'm bringing that experience to the mic so we can unpack the legal battles fueled by love, lust, power, money, betrayal, and survival. Today, I'm joined by Jake Deptula, a seasoned victim advocate and podcaster who also happens to be my executive producer and friend. Last episode, we broke down the contentious divorce between Charlie Sheen and Denise Richards. Charlie and Denise's relationship began like a love story, but behind the scenes, Denise said it was marked by addiction, emotional volatility, and escalating abuse, especially after the birth of their first daughter. Over time, she documented threats, violent outbursts, and disturbing behavior that led her to file for divorce while pregnant with their second daughter. As the legal battle unfolded, Denise sought restraining orders, supervised visitation, and full custody, all while facing pressure to stay silent for the sake of Charlie's career. Despite her fear, she kept pushing to protect her children. By November 2006, their divorce was finalized. Denise was awarded primary custody, and Charlie was ordered to pay child support. But while their marriage was finally over, their legal battle wasn't. And when Charlie met a new woman, things only became more complicated. We've got a lot to get into, so let's dive in. In July 2007, Charlie got engaged to Brooke Mueller. They'd met the year before, introduced by a mutual friend. Unlike Charlie, Brooke wasn't a household name. She'd done a bit of acting and had worked in real estate, but that was about it. At the time, Charlie was still the star of Two and a Half Men, an extremely popular sitcom on CBS. The role had made him the highest paid actor on TV. He was pulling in nearly $2 million per episode and had become a fixture in pop culture. In 2008, Charlie and Brooke got married. It was Charlie's third marriage.
This time there was a prenup. Under the terms of the agreement, if they divorced, Charlie wouldn't owe monthly spousal support. Instead, Brooke would receive a lump sum of about $750,000. Based on the amount of money that Charlie was making, do you feel that Brooke could have been entitled to more?
That's a difficult question for a lot of reasons, but since she was relatively an unknown, $750,000 for her was probably like, okay, fine. And I don't know what else she was entitled to receive. A lot of times prenups have, if you're married for 5 years, you get this. If you go get married for 10 years, you have this. So I don't know what other provisions may have been in that prenup that made that $750,000 a reasonable number. But it also could have been she just didn't care and agreed to it because she just wanted to marry Charlie. Around a year after the wedding, Charlie and Brooke welcomed twin boys, Bob and Max. Charlie's rep told the media he's a family man. He is a wonderful father. But behind the scenes, the story was very different. Both Charlie and Brooke were struggling with substance use. And according to court documents later filed by Brooke, the marriage was abusive. In a lengthy declaration, Brooke described an incident from October 2009. She said Charlie knocked her to the floor in front of two people, causing her to hit her head on the corner of the couch. She was knocked unconscious and had to get a CT scan. He definitely has a pattern. I would be surprised if that same pattern didn't exist when his marriage with Denise, but you can always tell someone's style of communications. For example, I can get a bunch of text messages from some person, and if you know that person really well, you know that's in line with how they speak or how they don't, and you can always tell if it's really that person or not. There's actually a way to get hearsay evidence into court based on prior communications with that person that seem to be in line with those prior communications. And so I say that to say this, it's clearly he engages in the same pattern of behaviors. When he's using substances, I mean, clearly that's what happens because I think when he's sober, we don't have any of this domestic violence, which goes back to the statistics of how often alcohol or substances, other substances are involved when there's domestic violence. I mean, it's just the numbers are through the roof on how often that happens. Things came to a head on Christmas Day 2009 when Charlie and Brooke were in Aspen, Colorado. Brooke stated in her declaration that she told Charlie she wanted a divorce. That's when he pinned her down on the bed, wrapped one hand around her throat, and used the other to hold a knife to her neck. He told her, "You'd better be in fear. If you tell anybody, I'll kill you." Brooke was terrified he was going to kill her. Thankfully, though, she managed to escape and called 911.
Charlie was arrested and charged with felony menacing, third-degree assault, and criminal mischief. He told police that Brooke was the aggressor and posted an $8,500 bond. As often happens in domestic violence cases, Brooke tried to recant her statement, but the case had already moved forward. A temporary protection order was issued to keep them apart, and the couple separated. For months, they had no contact. Michelle, can you share your perspective on this?
Well, I hate to say, walks like a duck, talks like a duck, looks like a duck. A leopard doesn't change their spots unless they want to, number one, and there's dramatic changes in their patterns of behavior. And up to this point, I don't know that Charlie's ever changed his pattern of behaviors because he still was actively using it this time. And so she didn't want it to go public. She didn't want the stress that went along with it. And she wanted it just to kind of go away, which is quite often what happens with victims. It is difficult enough to get the strength to leave, and even more difficult to assert your rights in a courtroom when all it is you just want them to go away. So, I mean, she did what most victims do, which is, no, it didn't happen that way, or I was wrong at that time. It's so common, unfortunately. Ultimately, Charlie pleaded guilty to a reduced charge of misdemeanor assault. The plea deal allowed him to spend time in a substance abuse treatment center instead of jail. He was also sentenced to 3 months of probation in order to complete domestic violence counseling. Around the same time, Charlie voluntarily surrendered custody of his daughters to Denise, who had filed to regain sole custody, citing what she called Charlie's marital turmoil, sobriety issues, and criminal problems. Charlie didn't fight the request and signed the agreement without issue.
Michelle, why would Denise request something like this?
Because you have someone clearly is in distress, and it's in distress for multiple reasons, because of substance abuse and then domestic violence. And she has to protect her children. And I don't think she really had a choice, because the other problem is, if you don't, knowing all those facts, then that can be used against you. Why didn't you seek to protect the children? And that's when CPS, Child Protective Services, can sometimes come in and take your kids because you're leaving them around an abuser or someone that's an addict. She may not have had a choice given the situation. On November 1st, 2010, Charlie and Brooke both filed for divorce. Each of them requested joint custody of their twin sons, Bob and Max. It was temporarily agreed that Charlie would have custody on the first, third, and fifth weekends of each month. But according to Brooke, Charlie didn't show up for those weekends. Despite having regular access to his kids, she said he never called to check in and made no attempt to spend time with them.
That winter, production on Two and a Half Men went on hiatus, and Charlie's life began to spiral. Charlie, who was 45 years old, started living with two 24-year-olds, a pornographic actress and a model. He hosted wild parties where he openly used drugs and alcohol, often to the point of hospitalization. And he wasn't trying to hide it. In fact, he bragged about it in interviews. He was living loud and proud.
When Two and a Half Men resumed filming in January 2011, Charlie showed up to set looking drastically different. He had reportedly lost more than 20 pounds and appeared to be using drugs heavily. He struggled to remember his lines, hit his marks, or work cooperatively with cast and crew. Before the month was over, he went on a 36-hour bender. Filming became nearly impossible. Jake, I'm dying to know, have you ever worked on a set like this?
Sometimes you don't know how high someone is until you rap. When they curl up in a ball and find a convenient couch or the backseat of someone's car.
That sounds like a very specific example.
Oh, I've dealt with people who have taken things way too far with drugs and alcohol on set, off set, when it comes to production. But we've had instances where we've had drunk people that I've worked with, first ADs on set, on film sets, that literally were most likely full-blown alcoholics, but they hit it really well up until about the second part of the day, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 o'clock. And that's when all bets are off. You see slurring, you see poor behavior. When it comes to drugs, it's kind of a hit or miss thing. Sometimes people are very good at concealing these things, but I think it's safe to say that by the time Charlie got to this point, he had already been probably 25 years into his drug abuse. He was probably been doing drugs since he was a teen. Most likely, late teens, guesstimating. So he had built up a high tolerance, but I can only imagine the amount of drugs that he had to do up to this point to be basically inoperational when it came to filming a network sitcom.
I'm baffled for so many reasons because the only drugs I've ever seen, other than marijuana, and that's a different story, have been like either the criminal cases where I defended people who were charged with possession of cocaine. I had one that was, it was like a liter of PCP. And so in Texas, it was like a, what we call a super first felony, where your minimum sentence is 25 years. But I can't even imagine doing those types of drugs. Like, I can't even imagine it.
The problem when you're working with talent, anyone in front of the camera, is that sometimes manic behavior comes with the territory, and it may not be something that is drug-induced, but it may be something they have to get into sync with for a character. So it's kind of hard to say. I mean, we've all seen these videos where some actor is berating someone on set, right? Because yeah. They get angry or they mm-hmm. get frustrated or they're still in character or things like that. So unfortunately, without a proper drug test or without knowing sort of the backstory or the history behind who they are, it's kind of hard to tell. But I think in this particular case, what was very clear is that there was a different Charlie when they wrapped the season versus the Charlie that they inherited after the hiatus. And it's very yeah. clear that he spent the holidays really just going down a dark hole of depravity.
You know, it's unfortunate. He was heading towards his rock bottom, I guess.
He's had many rock bottoms. I can guarantee you this. I know that even during the late 90s, they were really worried about him then. Because, you know, it's funny. He was in a movie called Money Talks with Chris Tucker before Chris Tucker really became big with Rush Hour. He had done Friday before that. Charlie had gone through some major drug problems. We talked about that in the Charlie and Denise episode. So he has literally been dealing with drugs, whether you want to call it addiction, whether you want to call it abuse, for decades up to this point. So I think it is a miracle that he got as far as he did up to this point. But you think he's the guy with the golden goose, right? He's a guy who's making $2 billion to stand on a soundstage and deliver lines that are written for him to an audience and be on a network sitcom. Like, you know what I'm saying? But that really didn't matter up to this point. Whether you want to say drugs were involved, whether it's ego, whatever you want to say, is that he really found himself caught up in a very destructive cycle of really willing to throw everything away.
That's an impressive level of addiction. So instead of stepping back to get help, Charlie took things even further. In a series of national interviews, he launched into public attacks against his employers, especially Two and a Half Men creator Chuck Lorre. Charlie told reporters, "I wish him nothing but pain in his silly travels, especially if they wind up in my octagon. Clearly, I have defeated this earthworm with my words. Imagine what I would have done with my fire-breathing fists." He also spoke at length about his personal life, calling himself a rock star from Mars with Adonis DNA, and referring to the two women living with him as his goddesses.
Charlie told interviewers he had kicked drugs and was now sober, claiming his home had become a sober Valley Lodge. But even while declaring his sobriety, he described his past drug use and what sounded more like pride than regret. In one interview with 2020, he said, "I was banging 7-gram rocks and finishing them because that's how I roll. Because I have one speed, one gear, I'm different. I have a different constitution. I have a different brain. I have a different heart. I got tiger blood, man. Dying's for fools, dying's for amateurs." He added, "I'm on a drug. It's called Charlie Sheen. If you try it once, you will die. Your face will melt off and your children will weep over your exploded body."
The interviews went viral. Everyone was talking about Charlie Sheen. His behavior dominated headlines, late night talk shows, and every corner of pop culture. People couldn't wait to see what he had to say and do next. Because of Charlie's increasingly erratic behavior, Warner Brothers made an unprecedented move. They suspended production on Two and a Half Men and canceled the remaining 8 episodes of what was supposed to be a 24-episode season. The studio cited Charlie's public behavior and his repeated rants against the show creator Chuck Lorre as the reason. I remember Tiger Blood like it was yesterday.
This is probably going to go down in history as one of the most entertaining public meltdowns of a celebrity that has ever existed in modern day media.
Yeah, it was pretty epic.
He is a poet with his words. He is a slayer with his verbiage. I don't think anyone could come close to the diatribe that he was on and the delivery and the cadence. And you have to say to yourself, okay, is this the drugs? Is this his brain? Whatever it was, it by far was the most engaging and entertaining. Sad in its own way, destructive, concerning, but you got to give it to him for being explicitly entertaining in his downfall at this point. It was so captivating. It's like the Symphony of Meltdowns.
Was it Megadeth, Symphony of Destruction?
Yeah, it really was. I mean, he's like a beatnik poet on meth. I do remember that time, and it was literally, what is Charlie going to do next? I mean, the tiger blood, when he raised it and had the sword, it was a shocking decision. 2.5 Men wasn't just popular. It was the highest rated show on television. And Charlie was the highest paid actor. Canceling the rest of the season meant losing millions of dollars. But it was a move Warner Brothers was willing to make. They couldn't manage the chaos anymore. Charlie's career was clearly in trouble. But he didn't see it that way. He claimed he had every right to live his life the way he wanted. And his attorney accused CBS and Warner Brothers of violating Charlie's contract. Not because of his behavior, but his retaliation for Chuck Lorre being criticized. I don't feel that there was any way that this was not in some way personal against Charlie. However, it's also very clear that if he was unable to perform his duties as an actor within this sitcom and jeopardizing production, meaning Charlie's late, Charlie's fumbling his lines, Charlie can't stay awake, hours add up on set, right? It's not just one person, it's 100 people standing around doing nothing. I think they knew who Charlie was getting into this show, but I don't think his behavior had declined to this point when he started the show, obviously. There's no way they would have taken a risk on him boarding the show if he was in the behavior he was as he was being exited.
As an employer, you have someone coming into work like this day in and day out. You just can't have that. It doesn't work. It makes it for a hostile work environment. It leaves them subject to being sued by the people that were working for them because of Charlie's behavior. Because I'm sure if that's what he said publicly, can you imagine what he was saying behind closed doors?
Most people, when they exit, they do it out of shame or they enter rehab right away. He wasn't taking that position. He was in a position where I'm going to live my life the way I want to. I don't care if you have a contract over me. I don't care if you're going to fire me. I'm going to sue you. So there is a case to be made for that in some ways. However, they would have to prove that his behavior at the workplace is basically jeopardizing the show. His behavior outside of that, technically, especially at this point when social media was barely, you know, ebbing and flowing, wouldn't have mattered. In terms of retaliation, I think it was an uncomfortable move. But to be fair, if Chuck Lorre was going to be targeted, I think CBS and Warner Brothers were going to be next. And I think they wanted to cut this off at the head before they started being thrown under the bus and before executives were called out by Charlie at that point. I would feel that that would be the case.
It's really interesting because I agree it's a bold move because it was a very successful show. I remember loving 2.5 Men. They had the right cast of characters that all worked really well and made a funny show. And Chuck Lorre is known for making really good shows. But I guess you don't bite the hand that feeds you.
This was not a contract negotiation, okay? We're used to seeing stars of shows either want to renegotiate their contract after the show becomes successful or bond with other castmates and say, if you don't give us all a raise, favored nations, then we're all going to depart the highest rated show or the highly rated show. But in this particular case, you knew it would have to get really bad if they wanted to jeopardize anything regarding a number one show. Because if you think about it, by just doing this, the show is going to get a bad flack. It's going to be looked at as cursed material. It's going to be looked at as Chuck Lorre can't handle Charlie Sheen. And so I think anyone from this standpoint would look at it and say, well, it really had to be almost inoperable in order to do this.
Yeah, I agree.
What I think happened by this point is that Chuck Lorre said, it's either him or me. That's what I really feel happened. We don't know this for a fact. This is all speculation, but they probably begged and pleaded, please make it work. Please, we'll get him handlers. We'll get him this. And Chuck Lorre said, I cannot work with this guy anymore. That's what I really feel happened because I don't think it would get to this head unless one of these two power players were going to exit.
Oh, yeah. It was a standoff and Chuck Lorre won. 100%. But how does the studio ever side with someone that is spiraling like Charlie was? I mean, they can't ever, right?
It really depends on the circumstances. I really feel that if Charlie had come into this and was falling apart, I mean, look at Robert Downey Jr., okay? It took him a while to get sort of back up.
Yeah.
But the difference is this, is that everybody's livelihood depends on this show. And if the lead is falling apart, the whole show craters. However, if the creator is falling apart and it's somebody like Chuck Lorre, who's the showrunner, it's harder to replace showrunners who have been at the beginning of a show, especially a number one successful show, than it is to flip an actor.
Yeah. Kind of reminds me of...
Suzanne Somers. I mean, Three's Company used that as an example. When you have three actors in a show and one of them decides to want to ask for more money or want to make demands on the studio or the network, then it's up to them to make that call. But it can still work, and we've seen that work in the past. And to be fair, this show wasn't necessarily contingent upon Charlie Sheen, but at the same point, he definitely was a huge part of the success of the show. I think that really worked.
Oh, he was.
He added a cachet to network television, basically a 20-year career of stardom and fantastic performances.
So, while all of this was happening publicly, Charlie and Brooke were finalizing their divorce. The terms of the settlement gave Brooke primary physical custody of the twins, with Charlie receiving visitation every other weekend. He agreed to pay $55,000 a month in child support. Combined with what he was already paying Denise, Charlie was now on the hook for $110,000 a month in child support. That may sound like a huge number, but remember, Charlie had been earning nearly $2 million per episode of Two and a Half Men. He could afford it. There was no ongoing spousal support for Brooke, per the prenup, but Charlie agreed to pay her a one-time lump sum of more than $750,000, plus $1.25 million for her share of their primary home, which he kept. So, let's break this down a little bit. Charlie didn't want her to talk, is my guess. And so what he did was give her more than she was entitled to, probably to sweeten the deal, so to speak, because sometimes you will tell clients that they need to pay something for it to go away in the divorce process or pay for more time with the kids. And so he probably made her a pretty generous financial offer so that he could guarantee some time with his kids, considering his history. Because based on his history, he should probably only have had supervised visitation until he'd had a year of sobriety under his belt, minimum. Until then, he should only have supervised. What they did in this, at least from what we know about what they did, he did what probably his lawyers advised him to do, which is pay her some more money so that you can get what you want when it comes to the kids.
According to Brooke, not long after the divorce settlement was finalized, Charlie contacted Brooke for the first time in a long time. He told her he was sober and planned to stay sober, and he asked to see the children. Brooke brought the twins over, and during the visit, she confided that she wasn't happy with where they were living. After all, their standard of living had likely changed drastically after leaving Charlie. Charlie told her he would buy a new home for her and the boys in his neighborhood. He said there were no strings attached. Brooke was relieved. She just wanted stability for her children. She and the twins moved in temporarily with Charlie while they waited for the new house.
It wasn't long before Charlie started making disturbing and threatening comments. According to Brooke, he told her once that he bought the house, he wanted her to give him $20,000 a month in cash, taken from his own child support payments. He said he needed the cash so he could knock off a few people, and that the people he hates violently are going to get severely punished. Things escalated from there. In an 11-page declaration, Brooke described a violent altercation on February 23rd. She said that they got into an argument and Charlie began following her around the house, shining a flashlight in her eyes. When she asked him why, he screamed, "I'm untouchable. I'm Charlie Sheen. I'm more famous than Obama." Then he pulled out a penknife and threatened to stab her in the eye. He also punched her in the arm. Brooke and the twins moved out after that.
The following day, Charlie called into the Alex Jones Show and launched into a threatening, unhinged tirade. Referring to Brooke, he said, "Where there are four, there are now three. Goodbye, Brooke. Good luck in your travels. You're going to need it. Badly." Michelle, as a former judge, would this statement be enough for a restraining order?
Yeah. I mean, holy cow. I'm always amazed at things that people say or do. Because you know it wasn't well thought out when they did it, and or they were in a foreign state. But the Alex Jones Show, I mean, that's a whole different topic in and of itself. That being said, calling and saying, where there were four, there are now three. Goodbye, Brooke. Yeah, I think knowing the context and the history, that's why when you do the affidavits or declarations that you attach to these requests for emergency temporary restraining orders or emergency protective orders, you have to make sure that you lay the history down well enough. Like, you really need to write a story about what happened so a court can see the progression of events, because some may say that statement in and of itself isn't enough. But if you have an entire history of stuff leading up to that statement, it can completely change how that statement is interpreted. So knowing the history that you and I know, Jake, I think that statement in and of itself would be enough to get a restraining order. But a person who is in Brooke's position that was unknown, like Charlie's history was unknown, would really have to just say, here's what's been going on, and now we're here, and so yeah, I'm fearing for my life. Just 2 days later, on February 26th, Charlie sent his house manager to Brooke's home. The manager took the twins, who were just 23 months old at the time, along with their nannies, and brought them back to Charlie's house. This was a clear violation of their custody agreement. It was the fourth weekend of the month. Charlie was only supposed to have the boys on the first, third, and fifth weekends. Brooke asked that he return the children, but he refused. He wouldn't let her check on them either. And because Charlie lived in a gated community, she had no way to get to them herself. I can't even imagine what she was going through at that time, especially knowing that he was in active addiction at the time and had two children 23 months old. The only thing that I think for her may have been a saving grace for how scared of her was she probably knew that the house manager was okay, although I don't know that, because if she knew the house manager was bad, then it would have been even worse. If I'd been really worried about their safety and welfare, I would have had a welfare check called in by law enforcement, is what I would have done.
The next day on February 27th, Brooke called Charlie and asked why he was keeping the kids. Charlie told her she would never see them again. When she asked why he'd taken the children away from their mother, he became enraged. According to Brooke, he threatened her, saying, I will cut your head off, put it in a box, and send it to your mom.
The following day, Brooke went to court and filed for a restraining order. That's when she submitted her declaration. She wrote, I'm in great fear that he will find me and attack me, and I'm in great fear for the children's safety while in his care. Brooke explained that she had primary physical custody of the children, and given the recent violence, asked the court to modify the custody arrangement on an emergency basis. She also requested new orders to protect both herself and the children from Charlie. The next day, police showed up at Charlie's home with a court order to remove the children. That's what I would have done after a welfare check. I would have gotten to my lawyer and said, we need to file for emergency orders based on what he's doing in violation of a court order. That's exactly what she did.
After they were removed, Charlie told the media that Brooke was fabricating the allegations. He posted on Twitter, winning, choose your vice, hashtag winning, hashtag choose your vice. It became a catchphrase, one he would repeat again and again over what turned into a week-long media spree. At the end of that week, CBS and Warner Brothers had had enough, and they officially fired Charlie from Two and a Half Men. They said he had engaged in dangerously self-destructive conduct and appears to be very ill. Charlie's attorney responded by announcing plans to sue CBS and Warner Brothers for breach of contract.
But the network and studios said they were fully within their rights. They sent Charlie and his legal team an 11-page letter explaining their decision. According to the contract, Charlie could be terminated if he was no longer physically or mentally capable of performing his job. The clause defined incapacity broadly, including any physical or mental disabilities, which due to the unique nature of a performer's obligation are not subject to reasonable accommodation. To support their decision, they cited assessments made by healthcare professionals, many of whom had never treated Charlie directly, but had observed his behavior in the media. Those experts described Charlie as appearing manic, bipolar, and in a hypermanic psychological state. They warned he could be in danger to himself and others and said he was in the need of immediate professional care. And that was just one of the reasons listed for terminating his contract. The basic gist of it is he lost his mind and he was fired. That's basically what they said. And it was due, in his case, due to substance use. You know, when you define incapacity the way they did, it doesn't say that it has to be a mental health disease or mental, like, you know, bipolar, schizophrenia, but drug addiction, alcohol addiction, those are all can be considered disabilities. And clearly he was disabled. Sometimes in court, we joke around about not needing an expert to say whether something happened or not, because sometimes it's so obvious that you don't need an expert. And Charlie is one where you just need to put the exhibit sticker on his forehead, because his behavior was absolutely outside the realm of anything reasonable. The only conclusion is that something was seriously wrong. No one needed an expert to tell them he was crazy. It was quite obvious.
Charlie didn't seem upset about his termination. In fact, he called his firing very good news. In a bizarre statement, he said, "It is a big day of gladness at the Sober Valley Lodge, because now I can take all of the bazillions, never have to look at what's his cock again, and I never have to put on those silly shirts for as long as this warlock exists in the terrestrial dimension." Charlie ended up suing Warner Brothers and CBS for $100 million. The case never made it to trial and was eventually settled for a reported $25 million. After Charlie's departure, 2.5 Men continued without him. The show ran for 4 more seasons, with John Cryer taking over as the lead and Ashton Kutcher stepping in as his new co-star.
Charlie was battling Warner Brothers and CBS publicly. He was also fighting a private legal battle, this time over custody of his sons. After Bob and Max were removed from Charlie's home, he went to court to keep shared custody with Brooke. At that point, the children were primarily staying with Brooke, but they were still allowed to see Charlie. It was a complicated arrangement. Both parents were struggling. Charlie with his very public spiral and Brooke with ongoing substance use. Neither one was considered stable, and the court knew it. So the judge issued a temporary order granting shared custody with a major condition. Both Charlie and Brooke had to pass drug tests in order to keep their visitation rights.
In December 2011, Brooke was arrested at a nightclub in Aspen. She was charged with assault and cocaine possession. She ended up taking a plea deal that allowed her to go back to rehab and serve probation instead of jail time. But things didn't get better. After being released from the treatment center, Brooke continued to struggle with substance use. Eventually, the court removed the children from her care entirely.
As you can imagine, Charlie wasn't considered a safe option for the children either. That's when Denise stepped in. She offered to take in Bob and Max, and Charlie and Brooke agreed to it. Faced with losing custody altogether, Brooke entered treatment again. Her representative told the media, "Brooke misses her children and wants to get healthy so she can resume her life and get back to being a mom." Charlie's rep also released a statement. "Charlie supports the actions of the Department of Children and Family Services. He knows Max and Bob are safe and in a stable, loving environment with Denise and the boys' sisters."
For months, Denise cared for the twins, doing her best to keep their lives stable. Eventually, the children were placed with Brooke's family and then back with her. As the years went on, Charlie's relationships with Denise and Brooke were all over the place. At times, things seemed cordial, even supportive. Other times, he was publicly attacking them online. I really think you have to give so much credit to Denise for opening up her life to these children, for the safety of these children to be able to do so, especially when she's dealing with the chaos around him in her own way as well with their own kids. I think it's really remarkable. It speaks to Denise's character.
I got to tell you, it's one of the things that made me like Denise, and not like I disliked her, but to do what she did was really a selfless act that was really to help out two children that very much needed it because their parents were in such deep addiction. So it really goes to her character. And I think it should be commended.
How often have you seen a scenario like this play out where the ex takes on their ex's new children from a new marriage and protects them from being taken by the state?
So I don't see it very often. You usually see grandparents or in-law, well, grandparents on either side coming in to help. So I don't think I see it very often because it is a very unusual situation. There's never quite a good enough relationship between the ex-wife when the new one comes in, but it really is a testament to Denise, because not only that, but Charlie, no matter what he and Denise went through, still trusted her enough to watch his kids with his new wife or third wife. I just don't see it happen very often. I see the grandparents, or I see aunts and uncles, or I see adult siblings, right? So if the kids have like a 25-year-old, a 30-year-old, some of them are even younger, will come in and take their siblings from a parent that has a substance abuse issue. Not very often is it the ex-spouse. At one point, when things were going well between Charlie and Denise, he let her and the kids move into a home he owned right next to his. It helped Denise save on rent and allowed Charlie to be closer to his daughters. But that didn't last. In the fall of 2015, Charlie had Denise and the girls removed from the house. Lord have mercy. It just makes me angry because he just is so volatile. And when you do something like that, you're not putting your kids first, but clearly Charlie has had issues putting his children first.
It was around this time that Charlie made a major public announcement. He appeared on NBC's Today Show and revealed that he was HIV positive. He said he had been diagnosed about 4 years earlier and that he was coming forward now because he had been blackmailed. Charlie said he wasn't sure how he contracted the virus, but since his diagnosis, he had disclosed his status to every sexual partner. Both Denise and Brooke later publicly confirmed that they and their children did not have HIV. Charlie said he had disclosed the diagnosis to people he trusted, but some of them turned around and demanded money. Charlie said he paid out more than $10 million to keep them quiet. He was done letting his blackmailers have power over him. That's why he came forward. This feels very concerning to me that there were a lot of people that were involved with him when he knew about this that he did not disclose it to. And that's my guesstimation. But I feel that the activity that surrounded his lifestyle at this time really could have generated a lot more people that were probably exposed to this than he even has a clue based on his drug-induced state at the time.
I remember when this came out and the announcement, because the girls that he had living there, I'm going to have to go back and look it up, but they, I think, made some statements afterwards as well regarding his HIV diagnosis. Because at the time, I think he saw those two goddesses living with him. I have to go back and look that. That was my recollection because I remember this coming out on TV and just shocked. And I mean, if you go back to our last episode where we talk about he and Denise, you know, remember she asked him to get an apartment where he would do all that stuff so he wouldn't have it around the kids. He really did what he wanted and to hell with the consequences.
Well, I think that to your point, his debaucherous lifestyle would open him up and those who he was involved with to a lot of different things, a lot of very dangerous things. And there was no person intimately involved within his life at this point that may not have been impacted or potentially exposed to this at any given time. And as we're talking about this, someone in a drug-induced state is not making good decisions, is not making safe decisions. So how can we assume that all these people were notified before any of this behavior took place that could have exposed them to HIV?
Right. Denise asked him this question back then during their marriage. So, you know, go back to the old adage of where there's smoke, there's fire. I mean, how long? A few months after Charlie came forward about his HIV diagnosis, Denise took Charlie back to court. She alleged that he was no longer honoring the terms of a trust he had set up for their daughters. Denise asked the court to order Charlie to pay $1.2 million, which she said would go toward buying a new home for the girls. Charlie's attorney dismissed the lawsuit, telling E! News, "This matters simply money, money, money."
It's unclear what happened with that specific lawsuit, but just 2 months later, Charlie filed his own paperwork, this time asking the court to reduce his monthly child support payments to both Denise and Brooke. He said his income had drastically changed since the original agreements were made and that he could no longer afford to keep up with the $55,000 monthly payments. Charlie told the court he was paying 9.5% of his gross annual income in child support. Michelle, is this percentage pretty typical?
I can't tell you what's typical in California because child support's calculated, but like in Texas, it is 20% of your net resources for one child and no other children before the court. We have a statutory framework of, you know, 20, 25, 30, 35%. And if you have more than five children, that's a different discussion. That being said, it's capped at the first $9,900 in income, although I think it just recently changed. that you look at for net income to calculate child support. So we typically know what max child support is going into court. And someone like Charlie in Texas would be typically max child support. California goes much, much higher on child support, generally speaking, than Texas does. And so paying 9.5% of his gross annual income in child support, I don't know, seems that off, quite frankly. Not for, if you look at four kids total he's paying child support for, I don't think that is that far off. In his paperwork, Charlie claimed that after he was fired, he made around $600,000 per month, mostly from his profit participation in Two and a Half Men. But now, he claimed, his income had dropped to an average of $87,384 per month. But here's the thing. The reason for the drop was Charlie's own fault. He had sold off his profit participation rights in Two and a Half Men for a one-time lump sum of $26.75 million.
When Charlie first made this deal, it may not have seemed the most advantageous way to approach this by taking the lump sum. However, this was back in an era when streaming was just getting started when it came to residuals, revenue, even the life cycle of a popular show. So if you look at it from this standpoint, now this would be a very valuable thing to do because when you look at certain shows, every year they lose profitability, mm-hmm. right? Yep. New shows come in, there's less opportunity for advertisers to attract some hot new show. I mean, use example of any juggernaut that has been big for many years, even a resurgence in that show is not going to generate the residual income for any talent that appeared in that show in a significant way. Again, at that time, syndication was still a very valuable tool for networks, for studios to use to sell their programming. But now that so many advertisers have switched away and are putting their ad money into streaming, into things like podcasts, into things like YouTube, TikTok, it's a different landscape. So I think if you look at this deal now, it's really not a bad deal. It's actually a pretty good deal. But when people look at residuals, it's like mailbox money. Isn't that what you said, Michelle, before?
It's mailbox money. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah, but there's something to be said about mailbox money versus the lump sum. You take that lump sum of $26.7 million. Let's say you never touched it and you just lived off the interest from that. That's pretty healthy. But if you take it per month, the chances are you're probably going to spend that money because you're like, oh, well, the next month's check will come in. You're not going to save it in the way you would, right? You just see that as, oh, it'll always be there forever. But every month it gets lower and lower. Every term it gets lower and lower until deals are made. So he was not making the money he was making while he was actually on the show. And that's another problem, is that he may have thought that I'm going to make this money forever. The same way he probably thought when he did Platoon on Wall Street, I'm going to be an A-list actor forever. And studios that approached me to be in their elevated projects, and it didn't unfortunately turn out like that.
Thank you for that explanation, because I didn't realize that in that business that you can sell the profit sharing that you get out of it. I don't know if you know this, but in personal injury lawsuits, settlements, the people that have them can sell them for a reduced price so they can get all the money now as opposed to payments they were receiving over time. So if they can do it in lawsuits, I can't imagine why they can't do it in business. I don't know why I never thought that. But let's talk about intentionally lowering your income. In Texas, we have a claim that you can make for a party being intentionally underemployed to reduce their child support obligation. Courts don't look too favorably upon that. If you are intentionally making less money, then you're going to get hosed by the court typically, and they won't reduce your child support if you're intentionally making less. That being said, in this economy in particular, there are people that start making less. And those are the times where the court will look at it to make some consideration for reducing child support. But in my particular position, while his income may have dropped to $86,000 a month, he still has $26.75 million sitting in an account somewhere that's earning interest and everything else. To me, it's not grounds to reduce the child support just because, yes, his income is less at the moment, but he still has the assets and he didn't have to reduce his income to basically a sixth of what it was before, because it was $600,000.
He is really just burning through a lot of money here.
Oh, yeah. He's bleeding money.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, it's easy when you're on a hit network show, and let's be fair, the number one network show, and making the $2 million an episode for basically given a week or two worth of work, and that's even stretching it because he's only called in when he absolutely needs to be on set, meaning for blocking, for rehearsals, for read-throughs, for audience taping days. So, and he's going to be treated like a king in that scenario. You know what I'm saying? Like he's number one on the call sheet, which basically means that he's second or even above the showrunner in some capacity because the showrunner has an ego, but the star is expected to have an ego. When requesting to reduce his child support payments, Charlie submitted financial records showing that his monthly expenses outside of child support totaled more than $105,000, including multiple mortgages, car loans, and credit card payments. He also claimed to have more than $5.2 million in property and other assets, but said he was also carrying over $12.4 million in debt. Michelle, when he originally negotiated these child support payments with both Denise and Brooke, he was in a much stronger financial state. So now, when you look at this, how do you assess the reality of his financial situation now, and how can that be applied to how that plays into child support and what he currently needs to pay?
Courts do take into consideration, or can take into consideration, all of your debt obligations and everything else you have going on around you, because your total financial picture matters when it looks at the ability to support the children. That being said, there are some courts that will say, well, too bad. You know, when you entered into this child support agreement, you knew based on your 20-year history plus in the industry that your income could fluctuate. But life can change. Circumstances can change. And the court could have said, okay, we'll reduce it based on all these things that you have going on. $55,000 a month in child support is a huge amount. Huge amount. That doesn't even include, and no one else has mentioned, the cost of private school. Who's paying the private school for these kids? I mean, there's just so much more into raising children than just child support. Ultimately, the court granted Charlie's request and reduced his child support obligations from $55,000 per month to just $10,000 per month for both Brooke and Denise. That's a huge lifestyle change. But if you were basing your lifestyle on child support, you got a problem. Like child support, I will tell clients, making it your lifestyle is a bad life decision. It should be gravy, should not be what you depend on.
There are a lot of people that go bankrupt from child support, right? And there are a lot of people who skip town and become deadbeat parents when it comes to paying child support. These are things that should be discussed prior to getting engaged, in my opinion. That's why you can become very valuable on those first dates when it comes to these scenarios.
That's why you bring your divorce lawyer on your first date.
Even if you've never been married, that's good.
But no, I mean, really, you cannot live on child support. You cannot. It's a bad life decision.
It is.
Because it can change. You need to be able to figure out how to support your kids yourself. And everyone's going to say, that's not fair. Welcome to life.
That $10,000 per month decision didn't last. Brooke and Denise challenged the reduction, and a new agreement was eventually reached. Charlie was ordered to pay Brooke $55,000 a month and Denise $20,000 a month. On top of that, he was required to pay both women 9.5% of any gross income he had earned above $2.1 million per year. Michelle, based on all the circumstances and everything that we've ingested so far, does this seem fair to you?
So I'm kind of curious about the disparity of $55,000 versus $20,000. That makes me think that daycare expenses were probably included in Brooke's amount just based on that disparity because they both had two children at the time. So I don't know why there would be that kind of disparity between the two, but for some additional needs of younger children.
I can tell you also is that Denise came into this marriage with a successful career.
Correct. She did.
Okay. So I think that if you look at it from that standpoint, if they were to weigh out what she has the potential or is earning per year based on opportunities, then whether fair to Denise or not, that could factor in. Whereas Brooke may not have had that. We don't know. We don't know at this point.
That's interesting. But yeah, I mean, does it seem more in line with his earnings? Yes. That being said, I think the disparity is interesting.
Well, Denise has never been known to be greedy because we talked about this in the episode between her and Charlie, is that she could have gone after his 2.5 men money. And we're talking tens of millions of dollars easily.
Yeah, and she never did.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think this really speaks well to Denise and her ability to negotiate, her ability to compromise, and truly the kind of person she is and was in this scenario.
Yeah. I don't think Charlie realized how lucky he got with Denise being his ex-wife. As far as ex-wives go, he probably hit the jackpot from her. In August 2018, Charlie filed yet again to modify his child support obligations to both Denise and Brooke. He said his income had continued to decline and claimed, "I've been unable to find steady work and have been blacklisted from many aspects of the entertainment industry." He added, "All of this has resulted in a significant reduction in my earnings." Charlie told the court he no longer had sufficient income to meet his court-ordered child support payments. Still, the document stated that he was willing and able to provide child support, just not at the level currently required.
While all of this was going on, Denise was planning to remarry. Despite the legal battle, she invited Charlie to her wedding to actor and businessman Aaron Fipers. Denise later told the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, "No matter what's gone down with Charlie and I invite Charlie to anything having to do with the kids and I." Charlie didn't attend, but he did wish her well publicly. Michelle, how important is it in moments like these for Charlie and Denise's kids to see them getting along?
So I think it's odd. I understand trying to get along with your ex-spouse, former spouse, to make it best for the kids. I understand that, because the last thing you want is for the children to see ugliness and your parents not getting along, because it's already hard enough with a divorced family. I don't know that I would ever invite my ex to my wedding, regardless of whether the children are involved or not. I think that's odd. Things didn't stay cordial for long. Months after Denise's wedding, Charlie told the court he was facing a dire financial crisis and reported an average monthly income of just $2,426. But then he said the previous month's income had been $37,631. So I'm not sure what the truth is here. He claimed his assets, including checking and savings accounts, stocks, bonds, and real estate, totaled approximately $5.8 million. According to Charlie, those figures didn't include additional housing expenses for the children that he had been paying for. This sounds so much like his arguments before. Not making enough, not making enough. Now, I do think that his income had dropped substantially. When we see this happen and you have a fluctuation in income like this, the courts can oftentimes look at like your monthly average over like a 6-month period to figure out what your average monthly income is, to appropriately set child support, which is probably what the court's going to have to do in this particular case, or what it would have done.
Denise pushed back hard. She accused Charlie of having squandered over $24 million from the sale of his interest in 2.5 Men to pay his personal debts and to support his extravagant lifestyle at the expense of support payments for his children. She alleged that since their last court order in 2016, Charlie had failed to pay $450,000 in child support, while simultaneously diverting more than $600,000 in assets to adult family members and converting thousands of dollars into cash for himself. Michelle, how often do people who owe child support to their previous spouses divert funds to make it look like there's very little money available to pay out?
So I think that probably happens quite often when it comes to higher income individuals who will use different business structures to hide money and or make it look like they make less. I know quite often on cases where we have a party that owes child support that has businesses that that person owns outright, you have to start looking at what they're deducting from those businesses to see how much money it is they're actually making, because oftentimes what they report on their income taxes does not match what their actual income is. And so oftentimes in some of my family law cases, we have to go get business records from their either corporation that they're the sole owner of or their, you know, sole proprietorship. But we have to go get the business banking account to see where money is actually going, because oftentimes you do see that they're paying their cell phone, they're paying their car payment, they're paying the insurance, they're paying a bunch of items through their business that they write off. And then that ultimately reduces what their take-home income is, which is what they use to try and say, "Here, judge, I only make this much." Definitely not uncommon.
Charlie denied the allegations and responded by calling Denise a coward. He said in a statement, "Dee and her legal posse traffic only in fiction. My day in court is painfully overdue. She is behaving like a coward and the truth will prevail." Denise stood by her claims. She told the press, "I was never bitter about my divorce. Going through everything, it changed me. But I love life and I'm a glass half full kind of person. And I did my best to rise above."
In 2022, Charlie and Denise's long-running child support battle finally came to an end. A judge ruled that Charlie would pay $0 per month in support for the daughters he shared with Denise, who were 16 and 17 years old at the time. The decision came after Charlie's attorney argued that he had been caring for the girls full-time for several months. However, a source told Us Weekly that at least one of their daughters, Lola, was still living with Denise. Either way, Denise was no longer receiving child support. I gotta tell you, being reduced to zero, I don't know that I see very often when you have minors. I think that is unusual. Now, if he was truly providing all the care for them and they weren't going to see their mom, then it may get reduced to zero. That would make sense. But usually there's some kind of child support order when you've got children under the age of 18, typically. So it is a little bit of a surprise. Because it had to go to court, I'd be really interested to know the facts that came out in the trial, because I think that would be very telling as to why the court basically terminated the child support obligation. I'm guessing there were some pretty convincing facts that dad was really the only provider for these children and they were living with him.
Even though Denise was no longer receiving child support, the public drama between her and Charlie eventually cooled off. In fact, they both referred to each other as friends in interviews. That same year, Charlie and Brooke resolved their own child support case after a lengthy legal back and forth. They reached a financial agreement, though the terms were not disclosed publicly. We know that Charlie and Brooke maintained joint legal custody of their sons, but the boys primarily live with Charlie. Brooke was granted reasonable and flexible periods of custody and visitation. She and Charlie continued having an up-and-down relationship, depending upon whether or not she was sober.
In 2023, Charlie and Brooke had to sign a new custody modification after Brooke relapsed and was found to be using alcohol and controlled substances again. Under the new agreement, Charlie would receive sole custody of the twins if Brooke tested positive for drugs and alcohol or otherwise relapsed until a new court order or written agreement was in place. The agreement stated that Brooke was required to test for drugs and alcohol as often as directed by her probation officer within 24 hours of a written request from Charlie or his attorney, and at least once per week regardless. If she tested positive, she would immediately lose custody and visitation rights. Yeah, and that's normal for substance abuse. We build in provisions when we use SoberLink or the random testing, drug testing, that there's a positive. Your possession or access is either suspended or it goes to supervised, or there's some other safety mechanism in place that makes sure those children are safe if you relapse.
In the fall of 2024, Brooke gave an update on the Hollywood Raw podcast. She said the children were living with her full-time and that she and Charlie lived in the same apartment complex, so the boys went back and forth as they pleased. She said she and Charlie and even Denise all got along. She called it a unique modern family and added that Denise had stepped in to help her more than once.
Then, in March 2025, Brooke opened up to People magazine. She described herself as a stage four addict, and that no matter how long she stayed clean, she always went back to using. Still, she said her twins were thriving, even though they'd seen a lot. She said Charlie was always there for her and for the boys. She stated, "We share custody, we co-parent without attorneys, which is great, and I'm very grateful for that. The fact he gives me yet another chance shows his deep, true heart underneath." Wow. That's my only thought on that, because knowing his history, I mean, you want to talk about power disparity? Ding, ding, ding.
It seems, for the moment at least, like things between Charlie, Denise, and Brooke have finally evened out.
But just when things seemed to be settling down, Denise's personal life took another turn. On July 7th, 2025, her second husband filed for divorce, citing irreconcilable differences. He listed their date of separation as July 4th. At first, it looked like a routine split, but that changed quickly. Denise filed for a restraining order, alleging that Aaron had been physically abusive. Aaron fought back, accusing Denise of cheating. What started as a quiet separation has turned into something far more serious. This isn't just a divorce, it's a full-on legal battle with allegations on both sides. And it's a much bigger story than we expected. So we're going to make it the focus of our next episode. So final thoughts on this one are a little bit different because the resiliency of Charlie to still be in his children's lives after all that he has done is impressive. You don't really hear much about a lot of issues with any of the four kids, which I think is also impressive. And it's a testament, for me at least, that not every relationship is the same. There is no norm for relationships, and there's no norm for co-parenting. And you have to do what is best for your kids and for you. Despite whatever disagreements we have with what Charlie's behavior, his ex-wives both found ways unique to their relationships to do what was best for their kids. Brooke has some additional addiction issues she needs to address, but they found a path. And that's an impressive thing that they did, was to find a path to do what is best for children. And as someone who likes Tiger Blood as much as Charlie did, to be able to do the same to some extent and raise, from what we can tell, relatively normal kids, kudos to them. And we can all find our way. We can all find our unique way to co-parent to the extent that we have another co-parent that's willing to do it, even if it's a different scenario than what most people imagine. But in life, you got to figure out what works best for you, what works best for your kids, and then proceed down that path. Thank you for joining me on today's episode. I'll be back with a brand new one soon. And remember, there are lots of four-letter words in family law, and fair isn't one of them. Until then, I'm Michelle Long, and this is Love Lust Law. Love Lust Law is hosted by me, Michelle Long. Jake Deptula is executive producer. Haley Gray is producer, writer, and researcher. Jared Landis is sound editor and mixer. Want to reach out to me? You can. You can email me at hello@michellelock.com. Want to find out what I'm up to? You can as well. You can find me on Instagram at Attorney Michelle Long. Just remember, Michelle is spelled with one L, and you can thank my mother, Margot, for that.